You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the early 1990s, Dr. Vittorio Gallese and two of his colleagues at the University of Parma made a somewhat accidental but quite remarkable neuroscientific discovery. They found a system of neurons in the monkey brain that fired when the monkey performed an action and fired when the monkey saw someone else perform the same action. They called this subset of cells mirror neurons, and in their research since, they've been trying to explain how mirror neurons are involved in the most basic human abilities, such as learning, communication, empathy, and even language. And it has been suggested the mirror neuron system may also be linked to the development of autism. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Vittorio Gallese to my show today. Hello.
Good morning.
How did you first come across this class of neurons? What tests were you conducting at the time, and what tests did you conduct to confirm their existence?
Well, our group had already discovered something unexpected within the motor system, namely that cells within the motor system that normally you would think that are there in order to enable our movements had visual properties. So we were actually investigating a class of these particular neurons whose job is to translate the visual shape of an object. See, you're looking at the mug, then you're aiming to grasp the mug. Well, those cells translate the visual shape and size of the mug into the motor program required to grab it. So we were presenting different objects to the monkey, and all of a sudden we realized that the cell fired not just when the monkey was looking at the object being presented, but well before, when we were aiming, reaching for and actually grasping the object. At first, that looked really odd, so we didn't expect it. We weren't looking for that, so we tried to falsify the interpretation that the neuron was indeed responding to the observation of action. And after a few testing, which took us some time, we realized that the visual response to action observation was indeed true, and that opened a totally new field of investigation.
Well, you had to determine that the neurons in the monkey brain allowed it to understand action, discriminate goals, and discern intention.
Yes, that's a quite recent finding. When you are going to, let's continue with the mug example. Suppose I want to sip the water that it's contained in this mug. So when I'm reaching for the mug in order to grasp it, I already know what I want to do with it, namely bring it to the mouth in order to sip some water for it. So when I'm programming this action whose final goal is to sip water from the mug, I need to chain different motor acts: the reaching part, the grasping part, the bringing to the mouth part, and finally the sipping part. So the intention of the action to sip water from the mug is the ultimate goal of a series of more discrete elementary elements of the action, what we call motor acts. So colleagues of mine, notably Leo Fogassi and his co-workers, together with Giacomo Rizzolatti, they discovered that there are neurons, mirror neurons, in the parietal cortex of the macaque monkey brain that fire when the monkey grasps an object or sees someone grasping the object, only if this grasping leads to a particular attention. So there are neurons that fire when the monkey grasps a fruit in order to bring it to the mouth, but not when the monkey grasps in order to put it away, so to speak.
Now, you were doing this with macaques, not with chimpanzees, not with some of the higher forms of primates. So I'm assuming that you thought, well, if it's working with macaques, it would work with chimpanzees and it would work with humans.
Exactly. So the next step was to do a brain imaging experiment that we did in Los Angeles at UCLA, collaborating with Marco Iacoboni and his group. And we show very simple video clips where a hand is grasping a mug in two different contexts. One context is suggesting that breakfast has to start. The other context suggests that breakfast is over. So at the briefing, all participants were able to say, well, in that video clip, the person grabbed the mug in order to drink coffee from it. In the other video clip, in order to wipe the table. So we didn't specifically instruct them to determine the intention of the grasp. Nevertheless, they were fully capable of determining it. And what turned out of this study is that when subjects are performing the intention ascription, when they are trying to understand the why of the action, why that person possibly grasped the mug, the premotor pole of the mirror neuron system lighted up. So that was a great finding, I think. Yeah.
My guest is Vittorio Gallese, who is full professor of human physiology at the School of Medicine at the University of Parma. Well, I would have assumed that we knew pretty much everything about how the brain worked by the 1990s. Was this considered a radical discovery in neuroscience?
Well, certainly the discovery of mirror neurons produced evidence which suggested to many people that we need to have different approaches in order to understand what cognition is all about. It suggests that cognition highly benefits from embodied mechanism. So cognition is not only explicitly thinking about what's in the mind of the people we meet in our daily life. There are much more direct pathways enabling us to understand directly, like blinking our eyes, what's going on in the situation. Actually, Jerry Bruner many years ago said, when things are all right, you don't really need full psychology. And I always liked this statement. Coming to the beginning of your question, we know very little about how the brain works.
And so we're actually at the beginning of understanding neurons as well.
Right.
How had scientists explained in the understanding of intention before you did these experiments?
The general idea was that you have a record of what's happening around you, and this record comes from your sensory system. You open your eyes, you see someone doing something, so you record that within the visual system, but the outcome of this visual processing has to be further processed by your cognitive apparatus, which most scholars tended to locate in the most anterior part of our brain, the prefrontal cortex. So this account of cognition is heavily relying on our linguistic competence. So to understand what an intention is, according to this account, is not so different from solving a logic problem. We provide a complementary and alternative explanation, which doesn't exclude, of course, that we might engage a more sophisticated part of our brain, but they most likely scaffold on much older system, and the mirror neuron system is part of that.
Before this, to some degree, we had only philosophical explanations, didn't we?
Yes.
And philosophers were totally off on this?
Well, you see, I don't share the opinion of many of my colleagues who every now and then try to bash philosophers, making the claim, oh, we don't really need these folks. Neuroscience will explain everything out. It's only a matter of time.
Well, certainly, somebody has to explain things first, and that might even lead us in the right direction. But philosophers propose that we don't really understand an experience unless we've had it. But you seem to be saying that's not true.
Well, we understand much more easily what we have experienced before. So there is a very important experiential aspect of our way of getting knowledge about the world. And this, of course, was one of the main tenets of phenomenology, of the phenomenological tradition. You see, when you address these problems from a neuroscientific point of view, you have your own specific language, your own way of investigating things. But as soon as you deal with first-person phenomena, with intentionality, with all these things, I think it's very useful to have a philosophical background and to open a dialogue with philosophers.
Where in the brain do mirror neurons live?
Well, as far as we know, for action and intention, they are within the premotor and posterior parietal cortex. And there is evidence also that some visual neurons sitting in the temporal cortex, investigated mainly by the group of Marco Iacoboni at UCLA, might be endowed with motor properties. Then there are other types of mirroring mechanism dealing with sensation and emotion, which are located in different parts of the cortex.
Well, mirror suggests that imitation is connected to the mirror neuron system.
Right.
Is this simply a matter of monkey see, monkey do?
Well, let's say that this system is perfect in order to enable people to imitate. Because the same neural networks fire both when you do and when you see people doing. So the mirror neuron system might explain not only the very early evidence of imitation described by Meltzer, so a newborn, as soon as engaged in looking at the mother, if the mother opened the mouth, it automatically opened the mouth. But there is growing empirical evidence showing that also imitational learning benefits from the activation of the mirror neuron system. So we actually learn by imitation using our own mirror neuron system.
Mirror neurons seem so basic to understanding others' behavior. So where in our evolutionary history did they most likely come about? Obviously, they go back into the development of primates, but do all primates have them?
The answer to your question is that we actually don't know. We just started experiments to investigate the presence of mirror neurons in rodents, in rats. And we have another collaboration with people studying imitation in the octopus.
Really?
Yes, octopus do imitate indeed. There was a paper in Science in the early 90s showing that they can learn to open a jar containing food if they are exposed to the same behavior performed by an octopus trainer. So imitation is very old in the evolution. And but we don't know much about the phylogeny. At the present moment, we know that there is a mirror neuron system in the human brain. There are mirror neurons in the macaque monkey brain, and that's it. Mm-hmm. We need more studies to investigate that.
I'm willing to bet that chimps can do it, that bonobos and pretty much every other primate can do it. I guess it's the level. We're recently discovering that monkeys or some primates anyway have empathy, for example, and that has also been linked to mirror neurons.
Yes.
Hasn't it?
Yes. So far, we dealt with actions and intentions, but we extended our research to the domain of emotion, and 4 years ago, we published a paper in which we convinced the participants of this study to enter into an fMRI machine, wear masks by means of which they were inhaling disgusting odorants. We wanted to generate in the participants the subjective feeling of disgust. The same participant watched video clips portraying the facial expression of disgust as expressed by actors. And the main result of this study was the very same part of the brain, the anterior insula, which is a part of our frontal lobe, which is hidden. You don't see it by looking at the lateral view of the hemisphere, was activated both when people felt disgust, but also when they witnessed the facial expression of disgust in the face of someone else.
So we can literally feel someone's pain.
Right, right. There is a vast literature that have been accumulating during the last 4 or 5 years showing that the same circuits in our brain are active when we feel pain, but also when we see other in pain. Right.
But just because the same brain region is activated when we empathize with someone, does that mean that we really understand the emotion?
Well, certainly the term to understand an emotion implies many different cognitive aspects. So there is also an appraisal component, which most likely benefits of more cognitive level of information processing within our brain. Our point is that without this direct embodied simulation mechanism, this direct link with the experiential feelings within the body of other individuals, our understanding of what does it feel to be in pain would be a lot more abstract.
Well, though we do seem to empathize more with people we know, like family members or right. loved ones, so there has to be another factor here, and that's probably based on experience or other parts of the brain.
I think experience and personal history is the word. In the late 80s, there was a very interesting study published by an American psychologist, Paula Niedenthal, in which they show pictures of people to participants. These people, they never met. And the people were portrayed in the college years and after 20 years or something being married. So the question was, could you pair the pictures of these people? And when the pictures of the people were shown at a younger age, the performance of participants was changed. I mean, how can you possibly tell who's the partner of who? But when the picture showing the same folks at an older age, after spending a life together, were shown, the performance was much better than chance. Which means that as long as you live together with someone and you share the same emotion, the same environment, even the way you look is shaped by this constant empathic mechanism going on.
My guest is Vittorio Gallesi, full professor of human physiology at the School of Medicine at the University of Parma, and one of the scientists who discovered the whole idea of mirror neurons, and now one of the most exciting areas of neuroscience. How are mirror neurons connected to the evolution of language?
Well, there are several lines of evidence suggesting that mirror neurons might have played a role. The first comes from an homology topic. If you examine from a site architectonic point of view, namely what kind of neural cells are present in the part of the brain where we discover mirror neurons in the monkey brain, what's their organization in layers, and you confront that with a part of the human brain which is mostly important for language, namely Broca's region, you find a striking homology between this part of the monkey brain and this part of the human brain. Then several scholars studying the evolution of language put forward many years ago the idea that language might have evolved from a less evolved form of a gestural communication. And if you add that the premotor theory of speech perception, which was originally put forward by Alvin Lieberman, who was working at the Haskins laboratories in the 60s, namely that you are able to decode the meaning of a sentence not just by analyzing the auditory part, but just because all the words uttered in the sentence evoke an activation of the motor part of the brain that you employ to utter the word, and we provide the solid evidence showing that this is not an hypothesis. If you put all these different strings together, then the hypothesis that mirror neurons might be involved in the evolution of language becomes more plausible.
Does it fit in with the theories of people like Steven Pinker and Noam Chomsky?
Well, that's a long story. The idea that...
Well, they say we're hardwired.
Yes. In a sense, it might be true. I seriously question that a language is implemented in our brain by a specific linguistic module. I think that what might be hardwired are computational way of processing information by parts of our brain, which were exapted in evolution didn't originally evolve to support language, but when the pressure led to the development of language, were a language ready and could support this new cognitive faculty. But I think there is a strong link between language and the motor system. And this is surfacing on a lot of empirical works that have been recently published.
In his book Social Intelligence, Daniel Goleman wrote that the mirror neuron system plays a role in the creation of sociopaths, Machiavellians, and autistics. Would you agree with that?
Well,
and how much would environment play a role in the development of them? I'm thinking Machiavellians especially.
Right. That is leading us to the nature-nurture
yes.
debate. I think you must have both. This mechanism, we don't know exactly, but there are components of the mirror neuron system that are probably hardwired. Nevertheless, the present evidence is suggesting that this system is developing, so it's strongly influenced by your own personal life experiences. So when it comes to autism, it might be the case, although this is still very highly speculative, that there is a predisposition to develop your social intelligence in a particular way that might be affected also that the particular relationship you have with your own parents. But certainly we are miles away to the old ideas that autism was a product of very poor education.
Refrigerator moms.
Right.
But
that's gone forever.
But you could see why people see a link between autism and the mirror neurons, because all the basic areas, the imitative, the empathetic, the empathic, I guess it is, language, they are all problems for autistic people. And these are all areas that the mirror neurons play a role in. Have you done any tests on sociopaths or autistics?
We just recently started a series of experiments on autistic children, high-functioning autistic children. And the results so far, which haven't been published yet, we are writing the papers, show that they have terrible problems with action imitation, problems with action understanding and action production, problems in organizing their motor behavior in a smooth, intentional way. So in other ways, their motor system is not able to anticipate the consequences of their own planned action, even if they are prima facie capable of performing the action as non-autistic individuals.
Well, is the mirror neuron system something that is genetic? So would that suggest that with autistic people, whether it's Asperger's or other kinds of autism, or sociopaths for that matter, that there might be some kind of a hereditary link?
At the present moment, we don't know anything about the relationship between genetic inheritance and the malfunctioning of the mirror neural system. We don't know.
So this is really just the beginning of all
right,
this research.
Exactly.
And I'd imagine that your field, which is also called social neuroscience, has gotten a lot of people excited. It's the big hot field right now, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Yes, it's a hot field, and I think we are just at the beginning of this adventure. And to be honest, when we first envisaged the possibility that some of our finding could be linked to clinical, pathological aspect of behavior, I was enormously happy, because it gave even more significance to our work. If we believe that in the future someone might benefit of our research, which is a very basic kind of research, so we would be enormously happy to help somebody.
This is where the line between science, neuroscience, and psychology is blurred, isn't it? Because you're, to some degree, in no way would you be eliminating psychology, but you would be explaining tendencies towards certain psychological states.
Right. Well, let's put it in this way. Psychology now can benefit of different tools for investigating the human mind, and these tools are provided by neuroscience.
So what are you working on at the moment?
Well, on several projects. One is the autistic projects. And
there is a difference between Asperger's and other forms of autism, so that could keep you busy for a long time just in itself.
Oh, definitely, definitely. But, of course, we don't have enough human resources to do all this study by ourselves. So we collaborate with child psychiatrists at our university and with other universities in Italy. We just recently started recording neurons from the monkey insula, which is a key area in social cognition in the human brain, but we know very little from a neurophysiological point of view. So this is a big project that most likely will keep us busy for the next 4 or 5 years. Then another field I would like to explore is the relationship between embodied mechanism and aesthetic experience. I'll be giving a talk at Columbia University tomorrow, and we have a paper with David Friedberg, who is art historian at Columbia University, where we propose an hypothesis.
And what do you mean by embodied mechanism?
Well, we talk about actions, we have talked about emotions, we have talked about sensation. The idea, which is an old idea, actually the word empathy is the English translation of a German word, Einfühlen, which means filling in. And these words surfaced in the philosophical debate about aesthetics in the second half of the 19th century in Germany. So this aesthetic literature has been put in a closet because it was considered to be too influenced by Romanticism. So in modern times, the debate on aesthetics has been mostly influenced by the linguistic revolution and classic cognitive science. We want to bring back the attention of people to the fact that when we appreciate work of art, part of our aesthetic feeling derive from the activation of embodied mechanisms. So when we see the static portrayal of an action in a painting or in a sculpture, our own motor system, our own somatosensory system, our own emotional system resonates and is activated, and that is part of the aesthetic experience. That's our hypothesis.
I wonder if the mirror neurons also help us recognize that a Vermeer is more interesting than some other painter who didn't make it during his period.
Well, we think that what is attracting us in an artwork is depends on the fact that the artist was able of capture something that we normally don't see in our everyday life. So an apple by Cézanne is more apple-ish than a real apple, in a sense. And so this aspect of human creativity might depend on something that is really hard, probably impossible to be pinned down in neuroscientific term, but we think that neuroscience could be of some help in shedding light also on this aspect of social cognition. I don't believe we will ever be able to explain art just in purely neuroscientific term. There are too many things involved in art. I mean, it would be an act of hubris, so to speak. But we can learn a lot more about art, even using the tools of neuroscience.
I want to thank you so much, Dr. Vittorio Galesi, full professor of human physiology at the School of Medicine of the University of Parma, and part of a team along with Giacomo Rizzolatti and Leonardo Fugassi, who came up with the whole idea of mirror neurons, one of the most exciting new fields of science these days. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Good morning to everybody.